The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
The main character of Plug is dirty and disgusting, and there's a scene in this film and you see he's got his big mutton chops, he's wearing a hat, he's making these grunting sounds.
The terrible Australian, Bea Jamine.
Marcy, there's a scene for poor Barry McKenzie where French police shoot up an entire box of Foster's beer with machine guns.
It contains coarse and explicit language.
Absolutely nothing. There's nothing there. This is This is a hole of a movie.
Mature themes.
I knew it was going to be a documentary about sex, but I thought it would be more about love and relationships and stuff like that. I didn't realize it was going to be about venereal diseases.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Ozbloit cast, the podcast that goes through every single Ozbloitation film right from the very start, from the early 70s. And we're aiming to get up until today. And for this episode, we are in the early 80s still. We'll be discussing five films from 1981 to 1982. And the films up for discussion today are Pacific Banana, The Survivor, Mad Max 2, aka The Road Warrior, Lady, Stay Dead, and Crosstalk. And joining me as usual is the other co-host of the podcast, Mr. Bede Jermaine. Hello, Bede. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Marcy. How are you?
Doing good, doing good. Very happy to be back on a regular monthly schedule for the Ozbloit cast.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. Because, Marcy, we have so many Ozbloitation films to cover, and it's a good thing we're back on a roll in regards to releasing this show monthly because, yeah, I mean, we're only at the very start of the 80s, and we still have plenty more to get to, especially when we finally make it up to do the modern portion of this show.
Yeah, there is a lot of Ozbloitation films, or, you know, including a lot of films that you could consider Ozbloitation. So we look at absolutely everything. That's why there's five movies per episode.
Indeed, indeed. It's a lot of movies for a show like this, but hey, if we did it one by one, we'd be at this show for about at least 80 years. So this is a good way to kind of speed up the process.
Yeah, just a little bit. Also joining us today is a first-time guest for the Ozbloit cast, but a returning guest to the Super Network. You can hear him on the Imprint cast, and you would have heard him on some other episodes on the Super Network. Please welcome Tony Mikus. Hello, Tony. How are you? And thank you so much for joining.
Doing very well, thank you. And Happy New Year to you both.
Also, again, Happy New Year to you too, I'm Tony.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. And it's an absolute pleasure to be here. You know, I won't say no to you guys. You guys are just amazing fun. And every time we're on a show for the Super Network, it's nothing but fun. Can't wait.
Thank you.
Well, we're glad you're here, Tony. But I guess before we actually get into talking about the five films we're going to be talking about tonight, Tony, what is your relationship with the Ozbloitation genre?
Well, it's actually funny. I started getting a little bit more obsessed with Ozbloitation a little late in life. I watched Not Quite Hollywood, Mark Hartley's brilliant documentary, and then I realised, what have I been missing in watching all these Australian films? And then I just got started and then wrote a bit of a list and got and tried to find as many as I could. And then I've just become obsessed with looking for some great classic Ozbloitation films. And yeah, so it's thanks to Not Quite Hollywood. That's when my Ozbloitation journey started. But I do know I've seen some beforehand, but you know, when I was younger, I never considered them Ozbloitation films. But nowadays, they're definitely Ozbloitation films, to say the least. But yeah, I'm really excited to talk about Ozbloitation. It's great, you know, being Australian, of course, and Ozbloitation's a part of our history, a part of our culture. You can't go wrong with it. No matter how bad the movie is, it's still great to watch.
Indeed, exactly. Indeed.
Yeah. It's a time, like some of these are a time capsule into Australian history. So it is fascinating, even if they are not the best.
And also it's been interesting, Marcy, kind of seeing, since we're doing every film every year, it's been interesting to see what type of trends there have been in the Ozploitation genre, going from one specific genre, then slowly moving into another, and then to another, and what is going on in Australian society at the time. So it's been quite a journey so far. And mind you, a lot has been happening with the Ozploitation within its first 12 years. So we have quite a few select films for this episode that I think kind of showcase different sides of that.
Oh, big time, big time.
But I guess we can go straight into it, Marcy.
Yes, our first film on the docket is Pacific Banana.
Our hero has a problem. I try to help, but do you think he listens? Not a bit of it. But I must be quiet or he'll banish me. Here he is.
I've got a problem. It's a bit embarrassing, really. For all I know, I might be the only person in history with such a problem. It all started with Lady Blandings.
Arrogant young pup. Of course other people have his problem. He's not unique. Unique? Sorry.
Hello there.
Oh, hello, Lady Blandings. Are you enjoying the flight?
No, I'm bored back here all by myself. I thought I'd come and look at your joystick.
Careful, lad.
I haven't got one.
Oh, you poor thing. They can do wonders in Sweden, you know.
I'm on automatic pilot, actually.
Oh, then what are you doing with your hands?
Careful.
Nothing.
That's torn it. There's no hope for you.
Look, I could lose my job, you know.
Don't worry. I've got the perfect opening for you.
Like waving your arm in a warm room, I'll be bound.
Special flight 206.
Martin, a voracious female is worse than a rampant bull. You mark my words. Listen to me, lad. Get out while you can.
Special flight 206. What the hell's going on up there? You're in priority airspace and you've had three near misses.
Tighter off, lad. You'll lose your license. Take hold of yourself. Let me rephrase that. Land, boy, land.
Directed by John D. Lamond, written by Alan Hopgood, it stars Graham Blundell, Robin Stewart, Deborah Gray, Alison Best, Helen Hemingway, Manuia Tay, I'm not sure if I said that correctly, and Luann Peters. The plot, which we have gathered from IMDb, the story of a pair of Australian pilots working for a small South Pacific airline. Paul, a wildly successful womanizer, leaving conquests at every port, and Martin, sad and lonely in his search for true love. Together, they don't do much of anything besides chase girls on various Polynesian islands. I'll kick off the discussion with my initial thoughts on the film. Well, this film was a bit of a flaccid cock.
Same word.
It's a very horny movie that fails to get the watcher horny. It's just an Alvin Purple film. It could have been called Alvin Flies and Flops. With that said, it is exactly that type of sex comedy film that was popular in the 70s. It has the innuendos, it has the boobs, it has the sex. It has attempted sex, but Graham Blundell's Martin gets horny and sneezes and loses his boner. That is the premise, in a way. It's about getting Martin to stop sneezing and losing his boner so he can have sex again. Martin gets a job as a co-pilot at Pacific Banana Airlines, and there's your title of the movie. And his co-pilot is another horn dog who just bones every woman possible, whilst having two fiancés. It is very weak and thin as a plot. It wants to be raunchy and crude and cheeky and clever, but it doesn't really achieve that. Instead, it's more cringy than enjoyable. There are some fun scenes, including, for some reason, a food fight in mid-air. Ending doesn't offer much else either. I thought the performances were forgettable. The voiceover gets annoying very fast. The penis jokes are flaccid. It just doesn't have much to say or offer. It's not something I would recommend. Bede, over to you with your thoughts.
Well, we've covered quite a lot of sexploitation films on the show, Marcy, and we got two people involved with this one who have been involved with quite a number of them, like John D. Lamont, who, of course, previously made Felicity, Australia After Dark, and the ABCs of Love and Sex Australia Style. And, of course, you got Alan Hopgood, who wrote the Alvin Purple films and the true story of Eskimo Nell. So these are two guys who are very familiar with the sexploitation subgenre. Mm-hmm. And you and I have had very mixed feelings with this type of genre. Like, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. So I was kind of curious to see how Pacific Banana would play for me. I guess my overall thoughts on the film, I don't think it's a good film, but I didn't hate it, mainly because this one, compared to some of the other ones that we had seen for this show, it was got to a point where it was so over the top, so ridiculous, and so stupid that I couldn't help but finding it a little bit entertaining. I'm not saying it's a good
film. You're terrible.
And also, it was kind of weird because this movie came out in 81. So it was kind of weird seeing a movie like this, which would have fitted very well in that early to mid-70s when all these type of films were about. So it feels like a product out of time already in the early 80s. But you can definitely tell that John D. Lamont and Alan Hopgood were trying to make, obviously, like the next big Alan Purple-esque film. And I'm kind of surprised, even though Graham Blundell's in this movie, I'm surprised they didn't just get him to reprise his role of Alvin Purple, because essentially it is the same character again. But it definitely kind of has that feel of the Carry On films in terms of being this really broady sex comedy. And like some of those films, it's not particularly good. But at the same time, though, there is enjoyment with it, with how ridiculous and stupid and horny it is. Like, I can definitely see your points in regards to the film and why it didn't work. But I don't know, I was expecting a lot worse, but it was better than I thought it was going to be, even though it's a mixed bag overall.
Well, that was quite something. Tony, what did you make of Pacific Banana?
Pacific Banana, well, how can I describe this movie? Well, it's directed by the king of Australian softcore porn, basically, John D. Lamont. I love the movie. I actually loved Felicity. I don't care what anybody says. I adored Felicity. But then this movie, you're right. It's Alvin Purple in the air or Alvin Purple with Pacific Banana. But it was something, how can I describe it? It certainly wasn't the Alvin Purple we know. Like, of course, Alvin Purple can always get it up, but this guy, Martin, certainly cannot. Yes, every time he gets it up, and then he has to have a freaking sneeze, and then all of a sudden you see this the flag buoy going up and then going down again. I thought, what the hell? Do we have to say that every single time?
Every single time. It's like, is it a wind balloon thing?
Yeah, it's one of those ones you see at airports.
It's hard to describe, but
I know it's an airport balloon thingy. We have to say it every single time he sneezed, and then. Oh, I watched it with my other half, and believe me, she wasn't laughing one bit. this movie is an acquired taste. If you have a thing for what Ozploitation's known for, of course, for the sexploitation titles, you know, nudity and some bad sex, have fun at it. But for me, this movie was, it wasn't great, but they had some fun moments, but probably the highlight for me was the actual Pacific Banana theme. That's it. But all in all, this movie was a little bit of a letdown because I love John Lamont's Felicity and Nightmares. We won't go there, but I do have to say Pacific Banana was not John Lamont's finest hour, but of course Alan Hopgood. He wrote all those classic sexploitation films, as you mentioned earlier. And this one, unfortunately, was definitely the weakest, in my opinion. So it was okay.
Yeah.
It was meh. That's all I can say. Meh. That's it.
Yeah. I think especially after something like Felicity, which, you know, I think, goodness, it was a few episodes back now when we covered that, but I think we all, you know, got something out of it at least. Mm. And knowing that, you know, oh yeah, okay, this is the director. Like, I definitely expected something more, maybe something with a bit more substance, and you could kind of mix those things in together, but it just felt like they didn't really want to. And I agree with you, Bean. It does feel a bit out of time in the early 80s as well.
One thing I noticed before, sorry to interrupt, but there's one thing I noticed that was very interesting, because whenever I watch a movie, I sit through all the credits and I watch every single one of them. This movie was apparently made in 79 and it got delayed 2 years. I wonder why, but well, now we know why, because it's terrible. But yeah, it was interesting why it got delayed so long. But there's like even more hardcore sexploitation films from Australia than this one. And I don't understand why it got delayed. But yeah, who knows?
I think, Bede, if you want to give us some trivia, I think the trivia actually kind of puts that, I think we'll put that into more context as to why it took a bit of time to get released.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like in terms of trivia for this film, one of the ones here is the production of Pacific Banana was raised in Australian Parliament as criticism for the then government for allowing the South Australian Film Corporation to make a film like this after it produced reputable films such as Picnic and Hanging Rock, for example. The South Australian Film Corporation kept its name off the credits of the film. So, you know, this is, that kind of makes sense to me because, you know, this is an unabashed sex comedy. And at this point, the Australian film critics had such a low view of exploitation cinema, but the Australian New Wave was still kicking in the gear and a lot of Australian films were becoming critical successes overseas. So I could definitely see why the Australian Parliament basically had major issues in this with this film, because it's like, you know, we don't want any of this kind of low rent junk kind of filling up Australian cinemas and showing all over the world. We want classy cinema to be playing everywhere rather than something like this.
Yeah, I can imagine this probably caused quite a stir, especially when they're like, you know, we've produced Picnic at Hanging Rock. What is this penis, flaccid penis movie?
definitely. In terms of other trivia on this film, this was the second R-rated Australian film for audience 18 years and plus produced by the South Australian Film Corporation, the first being Money Movers, which we have talked about on a previous episode.
I wouldn't have guessed that, to be fair. A lot of these films felt like they've been produced everywhere, and a lot of them felt like they would have been R-rated, but the fact that it was like the SAFC's like only second R-rated film, I find quite fascinating.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And also, the production borrowed a DC-3 plane for the film. It was an ex-US Army Air Force C-47 transport plane. What I find hilarious about the plane itself, you look on the outside, I think, okay, that's a reasonably sized, small little passenger plane. And I like the fact that basically inside the plane, it is literally the TARDIS inside.
It looks so much bigger. it looks so much bigger. It's not funny. They have a mid-flight freaking food fight, for fuck's sake.
I know, that was hilarious.
That's probably the best part, or the only decent part of this movie, I gotta say.
But yeah, it was like you could definitely tell, like with this film, it was, maybe this was just John D. Lamont wanting to make something silly. And I have a feeling after doing something like Felicity, even though I wasn't the biggest fan of that film, Marcy, but you could definitely tell that that was going to be more like Australia's kind of Emmanuel and being like this sort of dramatic, sex-driven narrative film. And then, of course, you have Nightmares, which you and I find as a guilty pleasure, as this kind of straightforward slasher film. So I guess after making two very kind of serious films, quote-unquote serious films with those two. I guess John D. Lamont just wanted to make something just silly and over the top because, yeah, I mean, a lot of the humor doesn't work, but you can definitely tell, like, they just wanted to make something just silly and stupid with this one.
Well, he succeeded, definitely.
I would rather watch Nightmares again.
But I do think, like, at least, like, most of the cast did well with what they were given. I think the two actresses, Sally and Mandy, played by Deborah Gray and Alison Bess, who are the pilot Paul's two fiancés, I thought they were actually quite a lot of fun in the film, and I really enjoyed their performance. And yeah, I think the cast do well with what they're given, but even then, though, Graham Blundell, though, like, you can definitely tell, like, he's like, really, I'm basically doing another kind of Alvin Purple-esque performance again, so, but everyone else is giving it all, but he kind of seems like he's kind of phoning it in a little bit.
I can't say I blame him, and I'm sure, I'm sure, like, you know, he's kind of done the whole Alvin Purple thing, and it'd been a few years since he'd done that, and then he's back to kind of doing a very similar thing. I don't know. Like you can actually tell some kind of story in films like this, but it just was really lacking, and it just didn't engage me in any kind of way. I think that's a massive, like, issue.
And that's understandable, for sure. In other terms of trivia from the film, which we had sourced from IMDb, according to David Stratton in his book, The Avocado Plantation, Boom and Bust in the Australian Film Industry, which came out in 1990, the film managed to play only a few days in a cinema in Melbourne and then a few nights in Sydney drive-ins before being hastily transferred to video.
I can understand why.
And of course, the song that plays at the beginning and the closing credits of the film, which happens to also be called Pacific Banana, was written and sung by stars Deborah Gray and Luann Peters, who played Sally and Candy Bubbles in the film.
Lovely.
And also probably one of the other decent things of the movie is the song.
Definitely. I guess this could be a wrap on our conversation on Pacific Banana. Marcy, your final thoughts and rating on it.
Yeah, so I give this 1.5 wind balloons going floppy out of 5. As I said, it doesn't really work. I found it very, I guess, bland in ways. It drags on. It's not that it's trying to be a lot of things. For me, it really just doesn't work. And I feel like this is one of those Ozploitation films you can miss. You don't need to give your time to it. You've seen it all before. I mean, really, if you want a weird, you know, sex comedy film, just watch the Alvin Purple films. They're at least better than this.
I'm going to give this 2.5 using the power of the volcano to give Martin a hard on, which was a very, very weird scene. But anyways, though, yeah, it definitely, as a comedy, it is very much a mixed bag. Like, a lot of the jokes do fall flat, but there were moments in it that I did find both amusing and also quite entertaining. And it's hard for me to kind of hate a film like this, which is so unabashedly silly and deliberately so. I guess in that regard, yeah, I'd just give it 2.5 stars.
Jeez, Bede. Tony, your rating and final thoughts on Pacific Banana?
Well, I'm going to give it 1.5 as well, Marcy. Yes. The thing about the movie is, as I said, it wasn't John D. Lamont's finest hour. He was trying to be silly, and he did succeed. But it just, as you said, fell flaccid. But all in all, it had some moments. And as we said earlier, the theme song was the highlight. But yeah, afraid it's a 1.5 out of 5 for me.
All right. And on to our second film, The Survivor.
James Herbert's frightening novel of supernatural power is now a movie.
What's wrong?
Someone coming out.
After all, I've just killed 300 people in a field and walked away without a scratch. That makes me pretty special, doesn't it?
The pilot is haunted by the guilt of his survival.
It'll come. It has to, Harry. I think I'm going mad.
The psychic is tormented by visions of the horrors yet to come.
They're asking for your help.
Who's asking for help?
The men, women, and children who died in your aircraft.
300 murdered souls combine their psychic energy to hunt down their killer and destroy those who profit from their death.
Are you sure you can go through with it?
He has to. Help us all.
Brace yourselves for a journey to the outer limits of nightmare.
You've seen the gates of hell, Mr. Keller. You survived.
Directed by David Hemmings, written by David Ambrose, based on the novel by James Herbert. It stars Robert Powell, Jenny Agutter, I think that's how you say it?
I think so, yeah.
Joseph Cotten, Angela Punch McGregor, Peter Sumner, Lorna Leslie, Ralph Cotterill, and Adrian Wright. The plot from IMDb: when a pilot becomes the sole survivor of an airliner crash, he works with a psychic and a priest to unmask the culprit behind the incident and to pacify the vengeful souls of the victim. So I really enjoyed the Survivor is surely a film M. Night Shyamalan saw and took inspiration from, with the first part of the film having Unbreakable vibes and the final part having Sixth Sense vibes. But also the film has a real giallo feel, like via the way of someone like Lucio Fulci. From the beginning, I was invested with what I was seeing. And when the plane crash happens, it's horrific. Very much Fulci vibes. And also the aftermath of the crash, it's very hard to look at. The mystery kicks in with why this co-pilot, Robert Powell, as David, got out without barely a scratch and everyone else from the plane crash died. But a mysterious psychic woman called Hobbs, played by Jenny Agutter, may be able to help David explain what's happened. I felt a very uneasy atmosphere as I watched the film. The horrific plane crash certainly adds to that. The mystery plays very loudly and you can hear it. And is it kind of like the souls of those who died doing a bit of like Edgar Allan Poe's The Telltale Heart? It all just really worked for me and I liked it a lot. Over to you, Tony. I believe you had seen this previously.
I have seen this previously, and I actually just watched it again last night in preparation for this episode. I really enjoyed it as well. It actually was a little bit better the second time I watched it. I haven't read the book by James Herbert, but apparently James Herbert hated this movie. Okay, it's not exactly his source material, or whatever. But the main thing is I thought it was really good. I love the plane crash sequence was actually quite effective. David Hemmings' direction, he actually did a really good job at this one. And of course, Robert Powell's performance. Everything so far, Robert Powell has not disappointed me in some stuff that I've seen.
Not at all.
Harlequin, and he was also in Ken Russell's Tommy, and as well as Marla, and he's been in a few great films. But, yeah, and Jenny Agutter, and, of course, Joseph Cotten, the legendary Joseph Cotten, which was his final film.
Mm.
And it did. Yeah, you were right, Marcy. It does have some M. Night Shyamalan inspired moments. Like, of course, he was inspired by this movie. But I should say that. Yeah, this movie was really, really good. I really enjoyed it.
Beat, your thoughts on The Survivor? I believe I believe this is your also... Fuck, I'm fucking up my words. Hold on. I believe this was also a rewatch for you.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Like, it has been quite a while since I've seen The Survivor. Like I said, I pretty much watched this as part of that five exploitation film marathon that the Fox Classics did, like, probably 13 odd years ago. So that was this was one of the films I saw as part of that marathon. And at the time, I was kind of mixed on the film. Like, I guess up to, compared to the other ones I'd watched in the lead up to this one, like Patrick, like Turkey Shoot or Dead Kids, which very much are very exploitative in what they do. This one is as well, but this one takes a much more kind of classical approach to its story in terms of how it approaches the supernatural, because it has that kind of mixture of being an exploitation film, but it also has this kind of serious elements to it. And it has great atmosphere. It's beautifully shot by future Oscar-winning cinematographer John Seale, who won an Oscar for The English Patient, and of course would also shoot Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah.
So visually,
I was just going to cut in and say, because I didn't have it in my initial ramblings there, but yeah, the cinematography, the film looks stunning. And when you know who the cinematographer was, it clicks, you know?
Mm. And sorry, also, that's all right. And also the score from Brian May. No, not that Brian May. is also great as well. And yeah, and it's also kind of an interesting kind of stark contrast to the last film that we watched from David Hemmings, because we talked about his other film, Race for the Yankee Zephyr, in the previous episode of this show. So watching this film and also that one back to back for these two episodes, it's like night and day in terms as a filmmaker, because as we sort of stated in the previous episode, Race for Yankee Zephyr is like a good old fashioned, big, bombastic action adventure film. But this one's definitely much more of an atmospheric, creepy horror film. There's also some genuinely creepy moments throughout it. And I can definitely understand, because I know that James Herbert was not a fan of this film at all. But I think as a standalone for what it is, even though I haven't read the original book myself, but I think as a standalone, I think it's just a pretty compelling little movie. It's definitely not perfect. It's a pretty solid one with some strong performances and from familiar actors who we have seen on the show before. And one thing I did take notice with this film is that I realized Jenny Ogata's character, she doesn't utter a single line in this film until about 45 minutes into it.
Mm-hmm.
And she's featured a lot in that first half.
Yeah, she's more like a presence until she does start to speak, and then it becomes more. But it's just, it's very mysterious how we see her throughout that part without her actually speaking. And again, like, I just think she's such a wonderful actress, and it's always a pleasure to see her in something I haven't seen her in.
Mm.
And same again with Robert Powell as well. And of course, one of the previous episodes we discussed Harlequin and how good he was with that. So yeah, I mean, I feel like there's just so much to offer with this film, and I really freaking liked it a lot.
Definitely. And I think Joseph Cotton, I think he does well with what he's given, but that role as the priest could have easily been played by anyone. And I feel like he was probably put there by Anthony Iannotti, because as we sort of stated before in previous episodes, Anthony Iannotti wanted to have really big international actors appear in these Australian productions. And of course, you know, he would get into trouble with some of the unions here in Australia about having way more non-Australian actors than people would have liked. to be
yeah
in these films. So in a way, like, not to say that I think the priest character could have been played by an Aussie actor or anything like that, but knowing how much of a legendary actor Joseph Cotten is, it's kind of really a thankless role that could have easily been played by anyone, really, given how small it is.
Like, when I read the brief synopsis before I watched the film, I thought that priest character would have been in it more, but he just barely makes a dent. So it's interesting. Maybe it got changed around or things got cut. I don't know. But yeah, you're right. It does feel weird that you get such a name actor and it's almost a throwaway role in the end.
Mm. And also the opening plane crash sequence is actually very well done. And actually, you know, it's funny, though, like watching the film again, like you were saying, like it that first half definitely have shades of Unbreakable. And that was what popped into my head as well, even before you even told me. And also by the end of it, like this movie has a lot of twists in the last half,
yeah.
which even though we are a spoiler podcast, I think in this case, we won't give away what those are. You know,
Best not to, in particular.
Yeah, exactly. Like, some of them are like, might be stretching it a little bit with the plausibility factor of some of these twists, but that third act was still pretty interesting. And also just, again, just how well David Hemmings and cinematographer John Seal shot and directed this film. Like, there's a great scene where we have Robert Powell just walking up this, like, big hangar and the lights just above him just go on and on as he's coming closer and closer, and it's just like a great shot. So there's a lot of great atmosphere and cinematography in this film.
That was a beautiful shot. Couldn't agree with you more there.
Definitely. Tony, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
Well, the only thing I could add was I had a little listen today to the audiobook of the Survivor from James Herbert, and Robert Powell was actually narrating it.
Oh, wow.
And it actually is not bad. He actually does a really good narration on the book. Like, of course, I haven't got the book itself. I believe it's out of print or hard to find. I think the best way to listen to it is through audiobooks in its entirety. But yeah, that's what I find fascinating. Like, but also Anthony Ginnane, he's one of the most influential Ozploitation producers out there, and he chose great crew. Great cast, even Joseph Cotten as the priest. And all in all, I thought this movie was really good. I really enjoyed it. But it was better the second time around after watching it. But
it's interesting that you both had that same experience, that it was better when you watched it the second time.
It was, definitely.
B, do you want to give us some trivia?
Indeed. Once again, this trivia is being sourced from IMDb. And according to trivia, the airplane crash sequence at the beginning of the film took several weeks to set up for filming. It was filmed on a vacant block on a land at Panorama, south of Adelaide, South Australia. Over 2,000 onlookers turned up to watch the spectacular scene being filmed, which took over 30 minutes of filming time for the film to be completely destroyed by the fire. I was going to say, Marcy, because I did notice at the end of this film that this was shot in Adelaide, which is your old hometown. What was it like seeing your old city in this film?
Apparently, South Australia was producing a lot of movies for this episode.
And even in the last one as well.
Yeah, I don't know if I could even tell that it was anywhere in South Australia, to be fair.
Mm. Also, favorite director of ours on this show, Brian Trenchard-Smith, made an 18-minute promo reel of this film to show potential buyers at film markets, and he also edited the film's theatrical trailer. And also, this film was nominated for 4 AFI awards, including Best Actress for Jenny Ogata, Best Sound, Best Production Design, and Best Cinematography, but unfortunately it did not win any awards. And also, I'm throwing in some extra trivia, which is not written here because I was doing a little bit more research. Marcy, the screenwriter of this film, David Ambrose, would you like to know what other films he has written?
Yes, Bede, please tell us.
He also wrote The Final Countdown,
mm-hmm.
Amityville 3D, Although he wrote that under a pseudonym.
Oh, interesting.
However, he also wrote a favorite of yours, Marcy. He wrote Daryl.
Oh, Daryl. That's pretty cool.
So, yes, the same writer of The Survivor also wrote Daryl.
Bam.
Indeed.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, like there's a lot of talent involved with this film. And yeah, I would say at least of the films we've covered so far for this show, The Survivor is definitely one of the more underrated horror gems, I think, that Australia has produced.
Agreed. Definitely.
Agreed as well. We'll get into our ratings and just final thoughts. My rating, which probably is not going to come as any surprise, is 4. I don't really want any creepy psychic powers out of 5. I was very surprised by this film. I was invested from start to finish. I really, really liked it. I highly recommend people try and check this out. It is on Broly. So if you are in Australia, you can access Broly for free, or you can always try to get your hands on the Umbrella release.
Indeed.
Tony.
This film was good watching it again the second time around. But yeah, as you said, Marcy, it is on Broly in Australia. And also, if you have the Umbrella Blu-ray, which I don't know if you'll be able to see it, it is audio. I am holding it in my hand right
yes.
now.
Yes.
There is also an alternate 81-minute version of this film on this release.
Oh.
So, and that's like 17 minutes cut out from the original theatrical cut. So, mind you, I haven't seen it, and I kind of don't want to, because I really enjoyed the 98-minute
yeah.
full version. And my score for this film is 3.5 out of 5 stars. Really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I give it 3.5 out of 5 as well. I think it's a pretty solid little atmospheric and creepy horror film that definitely gets under your skin as it goes throughout, and also just has a pretty compelling story, because you're also wondering, like, what is going on? Like, how did Robert Powell's character survive this plane crash and all the kind of the supernatural events that kind of happened around him? And also the supporting cast are all really good. Jenny Ortega is quite good as well. Yeah, it's just a pretty solid film that also is it's just kind of interesting, again, watching two films from David Hemmings back to back these past two episodes, and them being so different from each other that you wouldn't think it was the same director who made both.
Oh, no. So very, very different, but a pleasant surprise, honestly.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
And our third movie for discussion for this episode, Mad Max 2, aka The Road Warrior.
This is what it has come to.
Look! Out there! They're coming back! Come on! Move it!
Here is where it shall be decided.
Here it is.
Greetings from the Humongous.
In a world without gas.
The Humongous rules the wasteland!
I'm gravely disappointed that you wish to take the gasoline out of the wasteland.
Defend the fuel.
We'll never walk away!
Give me the pump, the gasoline, the whole compound.
This is a land that prays for a hero.
Well, if anyone's gonna get in there, it's gonna be you.
This is Mad Max 2. Max.
It's a long time since I've seen driving like that, man.
The warrior of the road.
You're okay by me, pal.
Gotta hand it to you, Treasure. The last of the V8 interceptors.
Every day we get weaker while they get stronger.
You wanna get out of here?
You talk to me. Now, to do the job, I need some high-octane gasoline.
Got yourself a deal.
You can run, but you can't hide!
You're gonna crash or crash through?
I was wrong about you. I'm sorry.
When it's every man for himself. And there's no place left to run.
Thank you.
left is one last chance. Pray that he's still out there. Somewhere. Mad Max 2.
Directed by George Miller. Written by Terry Hayes, Brian Hannett, and George Miller. It stars Mel Gibson, Bruce Spence, Michael Preston, Max Phipps, Vernon Wells, Joel Nielsen, William Zappa, Emil Minty, and Virginia Hay. Plot from IMDb. In the post-apocalyptic Australian wasteland, a cynical drifter agrees to help a small, gasoline-rich community escape a horde of bandits. I had not rewatched Mad Max 2 in such a long time. I don't quite remember when I had last seen it, but upon putting the film on for this recent rewatch, like all these childhood memories of watching this film came flooding back. Before I put the film on, like I struggled to remember it. But within the first 20 minutes, I just remembered everything. I remembered like all those times of watching it as a kid in my small bedroom with my little TV when it aired on TV regularly. Like, talk about a core memory unlocked. My most recent watch, besides the massive flood of memories, I just had a good time. It's the sort of film that does work as a standalone, but also Mad Max and Max as a character. And since that film, like, the idea of what was happening is just so much worse now. You know, Max is still kind of the same character, but he's more rough, as you'd probably expect. And he's aiming to survive, but he just ends up getting caught in helping others. And whilst Max wants fuel, because that's what you want in these days, you know, he offers fuel for his help. So you kind of get the idea, maybe he's still got a heart in there somewhere. But especially the little moments with the kid, I think they're some of my favorites in the film from when I was a kid to now. And the film gives us the craziest of characters. I mean, Vernon Wells as Wes, for one. The wicked red mohawk and those amazing arseless chaps. We have the mysterious Humongous wearing the sexiest BDM wear you'll ever see in the post-apocalypse. And Bruce Spence as the gyro captain is one of his most memorable roles. He didn't have to go that hard, but he did. And I haven't even touched on the stunt work, and you know that's still incredible. You can tell that higher budget absolutely paid off. And I think there's a reason this film was a hit and connected with audiences and is one of the best known Ozploitation films ever. Bede, your thoughts?
I mean, what can you say about Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior that hasn't already been said? This is a film that is up there as one of the more quintessential Ozploitation films. Like, even though the first Mad Max, which we have talked about, is the most iconic for a lot of reasons, and was the film that also helped Australian genre films break out overseas and also helped kickstart the post-apocalyptic subgenre in film. But for me, Mad Max 2 is just such a better film in every single way. The action is phenomenal. Like, that entire last half with the truck chase sequence is phenomenal, and it is absolutely insane how they did that entire sequence for real. Like, it's just completely mind-blowing. And also, the world-building is fantastic. The performances are all great. Everyone is just giving it their all. Like, even though, yeah, at the end of the day, the film is very simple in terms of plotting and character development, but it makes up for it in so many other ways. Like, I know George Miller has always stated a lot of time with the Mad Max films, like, he would, when he makes these films, he makes them as if they're like silent movies. Like, you can still understand what is going on in the story, what's going on with the characters without even hearing a bit of dialogue. And you get a sense of that in this film in particular. But it's just an amazing action film and just brilliantly put together. And this film, again, just heightened that post-apocalyptic subgenre of film, because we would see so many imitators come out after this film, particularly in Italy, because those are pretty awesome over there. But Matt, this film is just so iconic in every single way. Every character is great. There's so many memorable moments. I do love the relationship between Max and the feral kid. I thought that was such a great little relationship there. And also Bruce Spence, who has been on this show way too many times throughout the beginning, is also great as the gyro captain. And of course, Vernon Wells in his star-making role as the henchman Wes, who's great in this film. And it doesn't surprise me at all, like Hollywood pretty much just wanted him to be in so many films after this one. So yeah, it's just an amazing film that is just phenomenal on every level.
Tony, what are your thoughts?
This is my fifth favorite Australian film of all time. I discussed this movie on an episode on the show on the YouTube channel Disconnected with Ryan Verrill, and he asked us what our top five Australian films are. And of course, Mad Max the Road Warrior is my fifth. There's nothing much more I can say, nothing much more I can add than to what you two have said. This movie is an action masterpiece. George Miller, when he does a Mad Max movie, it's an event, especially here in Australia. But of course, with the first Mad Max that came out in 79, the American distributors made an American dubbed version, which unfortunately I have heard, and it's just repulsive. But I'm just glad that, and I believe in America, it's just called The Road Warrior because Mad Max didn't do so well theatrically back then. But then they released The Road Warrior, and it works so much better. And of course, Warner Brothers released it in a bigger budget, as you said. This movie is just a genuine action masterpiece. I love the stunt work. I love the cinematography by Dean Semler, and also, it just looks amazing. The Broken Hill location, you can't go wrong. It's just phenomenal. And of course, Mel Gibson, Bruce Spence, and of course, Vernon Wells. Come on, can't go wrong with him. It was great all. I love this film big time.
Yeah, I think universally there is just so much love for this film. It's very rare to find someone who says they didn't get some enjoyment out of this one. And I feel like for people in sort of this similar generation, we grew up watching this. It was on TV like all the time, or it would get rented out from the video store all the time. It's a quintessential part of growing up in Australia.
Definitely. And just, and the score by Brian May, no, not that Brian May again. it's also great too. Again, we got two very different scores for Brian May so far in this episode. And they're both excellent. One creepy and atmospheric, and one sort of big action-packed and bombastic.
Oh, definitely. I feel like because of this podcast, Brian May and not that Brian May is probably like my most like, it's probably like right up there as the most like for music and movies, that's going to be like right at the top. It's just because I've seen so many movies, it feels like he's done like all of them. So
indeed.
Love to see it.
And also we can't forget Dog, who was a good boy in this movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Can't forget Dog. No way.
Dog is beautiful.
Actually, my favorite moment in the film is like the scene where Max is eating the dog food. And then you have Dog just asleep and he wakes up and the look on Dog's face. But it's almost like, excuse me, but that's meant to be my food, not yours. And he's like sitting there just giving Max that kind of look. And I just think, Dog is such a good boy.
Yes.
And a shame that, sad, and spoilers for the film, he got killed. But he went out in a blaze of glory, poor Dog.
And do you have some trivia on the Dog, B?
Indeed, I do have trivia on Dog, because I mean, if you're going to have trivia on this movie, and again, sourced from IMDb, you need to make sure to have trivia that is on Dog. The dog used in the film, named simply Dog, was obtained from a local dog pound and trained to perform in the film. Because of the sound of the engines upset him, and in one incident caused him to relieve himself in the car, he was fitted with a special earplugs. After filming was complete, he was adopted by one of the camera operators.
Oh, that's very sweet.
That's awesome.
And also, let's not forget, Dog also knows how to handle a shotgun with...
Don't fuck around with Dog.
Exactly. Don't mess with Dog.
Exactly.
One of the spectacular stunts of the film in which one of the motorcycle raiders hits a car, flies off the bike and smashes his legs against the car and cartwheels through the air towards the camera was actually a genuine and nearly fatal accident. The stuntman was supposed to just fly over the car without hitting it. He survived, but his leg was broken badly. The moment looked so dramatic that they kept it in the film. And yeah, that shot in particular is insane.
It is insane. Mm-hmm. And
it sure was.
Like, just knowing that, like, you feel it. It's scary.
Humongous was originally supposed to be Max's partner, Jim Goose. The production decided against this, but left in a few hints, such as horrible burns behind Humongous's goalie mask, his raiders' use of police vehicles, and his own use of a similar weapon to the MFP standard sidearm.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think they probably decided against it because they wanted this to be less sequel and more standalone, that you it doesn't matter if you haven't seen the first one. And I think, for me, I think that's why they decided not to do that, if that was the original plan. And I think it makes sense because Humongous is just some creepy BDSM looking dude, and that's all you need in you know, a villain and their gang. You get what's happening, you know they're meant to be dangerous.
Definitely. According to George Miller, it was Mel Gibson's idea to make Max look as rough and ragged as he did. Before filming began, he cut his own hair and eyebrows, cut the sleeve off his leather jacket, and tore up his gloves. And also, in regards to Mel Gibson in this film, Mel Gibson only has 16 lines of dialogue in the entire film, and two of them are, "I only came for the gasoline."
I that blows me away. Because you feel like there's more dialogue in the whole film than there actually is. As you said, George Miller designs it to be visual, so you don't need the dialogue. And you get that from this so hard.
Yeah, exactly. And also, given how great of an actor Mel Gibson is, he doesn't need to dialogue to kind of physically express what is going on inside the mind of his character. He can show that through his face and body language.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
And also...
there's a lot of trivia on this movie, yeah. And we're not even going through all of it.
Indeed. I got to pick this one because this one's also important, but I have one more that I have to pick after this. James Cameron cited this one as his influences behind the Terminator. In Terminator 2 Judgment Day, John Connor's dog's name was Max.
Well, hopefully that is a piece of trivia that's true, because that would be pretty cool.
Also, unusual for an action film, this was actually shot in sequence.
I feel like you can tell, and I think you need to with the stunts that go on in this film.
Oh yeah, definitely. Like, they would have had to, that the first two halves, since it is, even though it does have some action set pieces, but at least they're kind of, in a way, kind of more simple and easy to do until you get to the last half where they know it's like, yeah, it's going to take a while for that last half. We need to work ourselves up to that last section of the film. And of course, finally, in terms of trivia, you and I, Marcy, interviewed one of the stars of this film, Vernon Wells, and our interview for it can be found on the episode of Podcasters of Horror, which we discussed the film Vernon Wells was in, which of course was The Christmas Tapes. And also you can watch the video interview of it itself on the Super Network YouTube channel.
Indeed. That's an awesome piece of trivia. Vernon Wells was just such a joy to chat to, and my goodness.
I still
can't believe we managed to interview him, and that's amazing.
Indeed, and we almost had, like, off the toot our own horns as well, almost had him for almost an hour interviewing him about everything. But I guess that could be a wrap, Marcy, on our discussion on Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior.
Yeah. So rating out of 5 and final thoughts. For me, I give this 4 arseless chaps out of 5. It's an absolute classic. It's so much fun to watch. Like, it's just, I feel like it's just a part of Australia as a country, as our history. It is Mad Max 2. Like, just mwah, chef's kiss. Beat.
I'm going to give this 5 stars, Marcy. I mean, it is not only one of the greatest action films ever made, it's up there as one of the best Australian films ever made. It's just a perfect action film from start to finish. The performances are great. It's brilliantly directed. And also, I find it interesting, too, because this film won a whole bunch of AFI awards, including Best Director for George Miller. But mysteriously, it wasn't even nominated for Best Film that year, which is even more puzzling.
That is weird.
Definitely. But I mean, regardless though of any award wins, like, the legacy of this film has been cemented. And not only has it been a huge part of Australian film culture, it's a film that internationally is one of the most beloved Australian films ever made.
Mm. And Tony, I think we can imagine it's a 5-star from you as well.
You have thought correctly. It is definitely a 5-star film for me. I love this film. But yeah, it was amazing that it hasn't been nominated for Best Picture, which is sacrilegious in my opinion. But yeah. it is definitely an action masterpiece, as I mentioned before. Like, when I saw it before Mad Max Fury Road came out theatrically, there was a special one night only screening double feature of Mad Max and Mad Max 2 The Road Warrior. That was a double feature I couldn't miss. And watching Mad Max 2 The Road Warrior on the big screen, hell of a difference. Even though I watched this on 4K, it's still
beautiful.
It's amazing, but it is hands down definitely one of the best action films. And I'm not a fan of action movies at all. I think action movies are pointless. But this one, I'm giving it, it's a huge exception. 5 stars from me.
Awesome. And on to our fourth film, Lady, Stay Dead.
She is Marie Colby, reigning sex goddess of movies and television, the unchallenged queen of the screen.
Same as usual. Boring. Boring. Do you mind? I'm talking to my agent.
But in 2 hours, the lady will be dead. She is the sister, Jenny Nolan. For her, a few days at the beach villa will become a night of stark, barbaric horror. Gordon Mason is the gardener. He lives in a world of his own, but in a day of mayhem and murder, he destroyed every living soul on the beach.
There's only one thing I want from you.
And now, he's going to do it all again. Chad Hayward is Gordon Mason, the demonic killer who likes to play games as long as he wins. And he usually does. Lady Stay Dead, starring Chad Hayward, Louise Howard, and Deborah Coles. Produced and directed by Terry Burke. A Rintea production. And now, for the lady.
Written and directed by Terry Burke, it stars Chad Hayward, Louise Howard, Deborah Coles, and Roger Ward. Plot from IMDb. A young woman is looking after her sister's house, unaware that her sister and neighbor have been murdered by their handyman, who also happens to be a serial killer. Well, movie, Stay Dead. I did not like this one. It was very difficult to sit through. Much like we've seen previously with Terry Burke, it's a very slimy and grimy film. It's also very mean-spirited. From the viewpoint of a serial killer, it isn't interesting. The handyman killer is just horrible to be around. I don't need to see him spying on women and having a wank over violent imagery. the incel type killer, he has no real motivation, I suppose. I call him an incel because that's the best I can come up with how misogynistic the film ultimately is. But is there a purpose? No. There was potential for something interesting to be here, but it just seemed like it just didn't really want to get there. Tony, what did you think of Lady Stay Dead, or as I called it, Movie Stay Dead?
Okay. My other half and I watched it 5 hours ago, and she didn't know what she was getting into, neither did I, because this is my first time ever watching this. And how can I describe it? Is it a happy film? Hell no. Is it a good film? Hell no. Is it a crazy movie? Definitely. But it is crazy in the worst way. It is one of the most depressing, boring, I hate to say it, but it is, because I've seen it all before, you know, these type of obsession movies with serial killers. But this movie itself, it was just, I don't know. I can't think of anything positive to say about it. Probably the only positive thing I could think about it is the serial killer looks like David Grohl. And, I love David Grohl, but I don't mean it in a negative way. But that's the only positive light I could think of this film. But yeah, this movie is very, very unpleasant. But yeah, it was just bizarre and odd. But all in all, not for the faint of heart. And also, if you're after a fun time watching a movie called Lady Stay Dead, don't. It's not fun. It's very, very, very bleak.
Yeah, you're not wrong at all. Bede, what did you think of this?
Well, I don't think it was as bleak. I mean, it is a very dark and very mean-spirited film, which I do agree with, but I didn't think it was as bleak as something like Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, which is probably like one of the first films that kind of popped into my mind while watching
Good
it.
Point.
This movie wishes it could have been as amazing as that.
You took the words right out of my mouth, madam. You sure did.
Well, I will admit it, from the very beginning, I was pretty intrigued by the film, especially with Chad Hayward, who plays the serial killer Gordon. Like, it's such a weird performance. Like, I do agree this dude is definitely, without a doubt, a misogynist, incel character who just wants to stalk women and just sexually abuse them in very disturbing ways. But the performance he gives in this film, I just found such a weird one. Like, all his character's actions throughout this film were just bizarre, which I guess that's what he was going for in terms of his performance in this film. I mean, it got to a point where, like, his performance was so bizarre. At one point when he's spying on one of the women in the film, he's literally having sex with Sad and basically...
he's having a fucking wank with his binoculars, and I don't need to see that for as long as I saw that.
But Marcy, he's had both his hands on those binoculars. He was grinding into that sand.
He really was. He was humping the sand, Tommy Wiseau belly button style. No one wants to see that.
But, like, we've talked about Terry Burke a lot on this show, especially with Night of Fear, End of the Dead, and also your favorite movie, Marcy, Plug.
But I do have to say, I love End of the Dead. That was good.
Oh, yeah.
Plug, I'm not going there. Sorry.
I think End of the Damned and Night of Fear actually like have something to offer.
Yes.
This and Plug do not. I don't know what I would rather sit through again. Maybe this? I don't know. It's I feel like there was an interesting movie that could have been there, but it never really gets there at all. And it's just uncomfortable. Like, you don't really want to sit and be around these characters at all.
Well, I think also, I guess, like I said before, like, at first the film did had me very intrigued, but after a while it did start to get rather repetitive and rather boring until the climax of the film, which is kind of bizarre for me, given the type of story it is. But yeah, I think for me, it felt like, compared to his other work, Terry Burke only had a thin idea for this story, and basically, like, this could have been a story that could easily have been either a 30 or an hour long short film, and then he's trying to stretch it out into a 90-minute film, because it does feel very ponderous at times in terms of its pacing and just having scenes that kind of don't really add anything to the film. And then, of course, once the cops in the last half come in, including, as our good friend Marcy Leslie says, Australia's sexiest senior citizen, Roger Ward. like, he's fun when he pops in, and I enjoyed his performance in the film. But yeah, it kind of is, yeah, by that point, you kind of just stop caring, essentially, because the story's kind of just lost any kind of elements that made it riveting. Although I do have to say, the scene, and I am going to spoil the ending, so apologies, audience, if you're listening right now.
Well, we have the spoiler warning in the intro.
exactly. When that motorcycle cop comes around the corner and hits Gordon, and he goes flying into the windshield of the car, I was laughing my ass off. Because that scene, and the cop goes flying as well off the bike, and I was just literally laughing so hard watching this scene.
You know what made me laugh from that motorcycle cop? He got shot in the back beforehand, and then he seems to be better, rides a motorcycle into the serial killer and then goes into flames. But then if you notice carefully, he actually, like the serial killer, I forgot.
Gordon.
Yeah. How Gordon was humping the sand, it looked like the policeman was humping fire. okay, sand and fire. Well, earth and fire. Well, what the hell?
Yeah.
Give it a bit of a, you know, there's something. But that made me laugh. It looked like it was humping fire. Yeah, but Roger Ward, as always, lovely man. He's amazing. He was my highlight for this film.
Oh, 100%. I think he actually gives something that you can at least, okay, that was decent in this film. Mm.
Do as you're told. Run, do as you're told. God.
Well, according to trivia on this film, which once again we're getting from IMDb, the film did not receive a theatrical release in its native Australia, but went straight to video, bar from a few theatrical screenings. The picture in December 1981 was intended to get a theatrical release, but local distributors wouldn't have a bar of it.
And I can understand why.
Indeed. In the documentary, Not Quite Hollywood, Roger Ward comments that Terry Burke was so enthusiastic about the fish tank murder scene that he refused to call cut until he was satisfied, and that Deborah Cools did the stunt herself and nearly drowned in the enacting of it.
Yeah, that's a bit full on, to be fair. I can understand in the moment and you're excited about a scene and whatnot, but when someone's life and safety is at risk, don't be like putting them to the point they're nearly going to drown. And to be honest, I felt like that scene was not worth her risking her life.
No.
Yeah, definitely not. Definitely not. Also, finally, this was the final theatrical feature of Australian exploitation director Terry Burke. His next film, Brothers, was a TV film that also went straight to video. And based on what other information I've read, this was the last exploitation film he made as well. So he's definitely had quite a mixed bag of exploitation films since we've covered him on the show. Between the four, sure. Between the four that we have talked about in previous episodes. So I guess you could definitely say it's a mixed bag, because you could say, Marcy, there's been two that we liked and two that we didn't think much of.
Yeah, pretty much. And I actually find it interesting on this other bit of trivia that I'll just read out. The movie was not released in the US for about 5 years, with the film debuting stateside on home video in 1986. And you could imagine this kind of period in the early to mid 80s, a lot of movies were facing a lot of controversy, a lot of censorship. Of course, the UK had the video nasties and such. So I think a lot of this, with it not receiving a theatrical release, it didn't get released in the US for years later. I think that definitely played a part in a lot of that as well. And yes, we'll get straight to our rating and final thoughts. This gets 1.5 Handyman Stay Dead Already out of 5. Much like Terry Burke's other film Plug, I did not really think much of this at all. It's a very hard film to recommend. I guess if you like, for some reason, the kind of very grimy and slimy kind of exploitation films, maybe, but this was a struggle. Tony, what about for you?
If you're after a happy film, don't watch this movie. If you want to see men humping sand and fire, watch this film. but all in all, yes, I do agree with you, Marcy. This is a 1.5 out of 5. I would have given it lower, but Roger Ward saved it, as always. So just from his comic performance alone, this movie does get 1.5 out of 5 from me.
Yeah, I agree with the reasoning as well. Bede, your rating and final thoughts.
I give this one about a 2 out of 5. Like, I think the first half and the last half were definitely the most interesting to me, but it just really suffers from a very sluggish and rather dull middle section. And like you both said, it is a very unpleasant film, and I believe, yeah, without a doubt, that is by design. So this isn't a film that you're meant to enjoy whatsoever. But even then, though, like, even if it is kind of going for that sort of gritty, grimy unpleasantness, for most part, I just found it just mostly dull. Like, I've seen better versions of this type of film before and after its release. So in that regard, like, yeah, it has some qualities I think are pretty solid. But yeah, for most part, it's just a rather dull film.
And to our final film for this episode, Crosstalk.
Now the computer has come of age. It outgrows its human designers. It is an electronic being watching, waiting. It will outprogram their most secret strategies. Its memory will store their darkest secrets. Saw the murder and liked what it saw. When you're planning murder, make sure the computer doesn't know about it.
Directed by Mark Egerton and Keith Salvat, and we'll get into that. Written by Linda Lane, Mark Egerton, and Dennis Whitburn. It stars Gary Day, Penny Downey, Brian McDermott, Peter Collingwood, and Kim Deacon. The plot from IMDb. A computer genius is confined to a penthouse after a car accident with only a nurse to look after him. But the advanced computer systems designed to make his life easier appear to be taking control. Well, this one is Man's Computer Thinks It's HAL 9000, starring in a remake of Rear Window. It's not a bad premise at all. And we certainly saw the rise of fear of technology kind of during this time period. It was very big in the 80s. But the problem I had with the film is it was rather dull. And even despite its short running time, it felt like it took far too long to get anywhere. And then ultimately it just felt pointless. There are some positives. I thought the cinematography was really nice, and there's definitely some style in there. The main performance from Gary Day is enjoyable, even if the film kind of lacks anything for him, I suppose. I can kind of see what it was aiming for, but I think a lot of the behind-the-scenes issues and rewrites didn't really help create anything much of substance. And I guess when we discuss a bit more, we'll get into some of the behind the scenes on the film. Bede, what did you think of Crosstalk?
Well, this one's interesting because this is like one of the earliest Australian sci-fi films, Marcy. So on that front, I was very curious to see how it would work. And the only real thing I kind of knew about this film was it dealt with an advanced computer that can think and do stuff. So I thought, okay, I'm kind of curious to see how this film does it with that premise. I got to say this, and I got to be absolutely honest. Out of all the films we have covered on this episode of the show, this is without a doubt the worst one for me. I found this film an absolute chore from beginning to end. Like, at first I thought, because I didn't read up much of the synopsis before I started watching it. So I just knew it was about a computer. That's all I knew. So I thought, okay, this is going to be one where, at least in the first half, I kind of thought, okay, this is going to be one where our main character, he gets into an accident that's caused by this advanced supercomputer. And I thought, okay, the supercomputer is basically going to torment him or stalk him and stuff like that. But then, as you say, Marcy, it becomes basically a remake of Rear Window.
Which we already saw on our previous episode, because Road Games is kind of like a Rear Window on the open road.
Yeah, well, the difference between that and this is, at least with...
One's a good movie?
But with Road Games, it does take the Rear Window premise and does its own spin on it and creates something new and different by having it, you know, set on the road. And with, but this film, though, like, it literally hits the exact same beats of Rear Window, with the main character being in this apartment, looking across the way, seeing that a possible, like, his supercomputer witnesses a murder and him trying to figure out if it actually happened, and also throwing in this kind of, I guess, thematic elements with this company that he's working for telling him to rush making this supercomputer so they can get it out there. And of course, the company being involved with this murder as well. Like, there's so much going on in this film that feels very muddled and convoluted and kind of uneven in terms of its script. And it doesn't surprise me at all, given what happened on this film behind the scenes, which we'll talk about in a second. But yeah, honestly, I really did not like this film at all. I really did not like it at all.
Considering we've talked about Pacific Banana and Lady Stay Dead, and this was the one that you liked the least, I am quite shocked. But
well, to be fair,
this isn't To Be Tuesday's body.
Well, at least with Pacific Banana and Lady Stay Dead, they had elements I found interesting. This movie is just literally just Rear Window with a supercomputer in it. That's it. That's the entire premise.
And it feels like, as I said, it reminded me of like a HAL computer from 2001 A Space Odyssey, but I also felt like someone was trying to be Stanley Kubrick with how they were doing this movie at the beginning. I don't know. Tony, I'm very interested to hear what you made of Crosstalk.
Well, it is Rear Window with a computer, but don't forget BDSM. But the movie itself, I agree with you. I agree with both of you. It definitely is Rear Window with a robot. But yeah, I don't know. This is just one of those movies that it's forgettable. It definitely, I watched it a couple of days ago and I just don't remember it. I just think it's just a little bit, it's one of those It's unfortunate because it did it kind of reminded me of Electric Dreams while I was watching it.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that kind of element to it, but that is such a far better movie.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. With Electric Dreams is an 80s classic. You can't go wrong with that one. But with this one, even though that was made in the 80s as well, it was just forgettable. Like the performances from the main character who's paralyzed, who had an accident, he was okay. He was probably the highlight. But all in all, the movie was just, it was a forgetful film. It was a forgettable movie.
I don't know if there's really much to say about this one because, like we've said, it's how the computer being in doing a rear window for some reason. As we sort of alluded to, there was a lot of behind the scenes stuff with this film. So do you want to give us some of the trivia, which I think probably shed some light as to why the film kind of turned out the way it did?
Oh, definitely, definitely. Well, first up, the film was originally directed by Keith Salvat. He was the original director and co-writer of the film. However, he only worked on the film for 19 days before being replaced. And that's when they brought in Mark Egerton, who was the assistant director on the film, to take over directorial duties. And also to kind of bounce off that trivia as well, production on the film was shut down for a week so Mark Egerton and Dennis Whitburn could rewrite the script. And also, only a few scenes from original director Keith Salvat was shot and ended up in the final cut.
It makes me wonder what those scenes might have been. And it doesn't really say, I don't think, like, what happened. But just knowing that we had a change of director, a script rewrite, and the film just feels like it's not fleshed out, like nothing's really there. I am curious, but I guess I don't know if we'll ever know.
Yeah, I think so too, because like I would imagine, given that if a director is being replaced that late into the filming of it and also needing a new director to come in and also rewrite the script, I can only imagine if this was a case where, and again, I'm only speculating about this, whether the producers of the film looked at the dailies, were not impressed at all by what they were seeing, and basically decided that, you know what, we're not happy with this. This is not working. And we're going to have to fire the director and bring somebody else on. Looking at that, and I thought, you know what else has Keith Salvat worked on? Like, he's barely had any projects before and since. So I guess in a way, this was meant to be like his first... well, actually, it says here that he had a couple of films beforehand. I'm assuming maybe, yeah, they just weren't happy with his work and then decided to just fire him and bring somebody else on.
It could be that maybe just the experience wasn't there, but... This was also the debut theatrical feature directed by Mark Egerton. So I don't know how much experience he would have, Mark Egerton would have had being as an assistant director. And also the first starring role in a theatrical feature for Gary Day. And for his first like starring role, I thought he was pretty decent. I think it was probably one of the things I kind of enjoyed, if you could say that, with the film. But yeah, like for me, and I think for you two as well, these kind of things make sense as to why this film just doesn't feel like a proper film.
Definitely.
So much is clearly missing or just not in there.
Yeah, and maybe that's probably why it feels so uneven and muddled as a whole, because again, it was changed. The script was changed during the filming of it. But what I find interesting is I'm doing some research right now, Mark Egerton, he only directed one other film after this, and that was a film called The Winds of Jarrah. But after this, though, he saying that when he worked on Crosstalk, he was an assistant director, he would still continue that after these two films, and actually has quite an impressive collection of credits as an assistant director on And I'll read some of these out. He was assistant director on quite a number Australian films, such as The Year of Living Dangerously, The Fringe Dwellers, but he would also work on international productions, such as The Mosquito Coast, Species, 12 Monkeys, The Saint, 7 Years in Tibet, Underworld, Alien vs. Predator, The Black Dahlia, Resident Evil Extinction, Death Race, and Mao's Last Dancer.
That's quite a crazy, like, bunch of assistant director gigs there.
And he was the first assistant director, too, so that's a pretty high up there in terms of assistant directors on a production.
Or maybe a assistant director, like, first assistant director was what Mark was better at rather than directing the film on its own, so...
Yeah, I guess so. Like, that would actually explain a lot, but yeah, you're right. I mean, it's really kind of a nothing film. I mean, the fact that we've barely even kind of talked about it kind of just says so much about it.
There's not really too much to say, but there is one piece of trivia that I actually had no idea about. Bea, do you want to give us that one?
This this 1982 Australian feature film was not released on DVD until 2020. Previously, after its 1982 theatrical release in Australia, it had been released on home video on VHS and Beta in 1983. The interval between its Australian tape and the Australian disc releases was about 37 years.
And this tells you exactly why we need physical media.
Exactly. Even though, because I do have the DVD of this film, or at least I do have it until I give it away very soon.
you kind don't of need it in your collection, but you still, we need evidence of movies.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, that existed. It's part of history, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's important that even a film like this, even if we're not big on it at all, needs to be released on physical media. But I do find it interesting, though, when Umbrella released this on DVD, when I started the movie, it just started playing the movie. No menu, nothing. It just went straight into the film. And mind you, the copy they must have been given must have been a very, very old print, because it's not restored at all, so it's pretty banged up. So I mean, as annoying as that is, but again, you know, as we're in the last couple of months in regards to the importance of physical media, it's important that a film like this gets some kind of release, even if it's like ripped from a VHS or something like that.
I believe that every piece of film should be archived to be seen, at least have something stored somewhere. But I just don't feel like there's no reason to hold back releasing films in a physical form or something. Have something like archive.org, but you could set it up as like a kind of library or something, and you can get a certain amount of time to watch something, but at least the option's there. I think, you know, it's important, and that's part of the discussion with a lot of these Ozploitation films, is some of them are so hard to find. Some have not been seen since they were on TV, and the only way we've been able to see it is because someone got a recording of it. So I protect movies at all costs.
Yeah, definitely. And Tony, as someone who hosts two podcasts on physical media, how do you feel about this?
I agree. Even though it's a crap film or whatever it is, have something, like, because everybody has different tastes in film. Like, I love bad movies myself as well, but I'm just saying it'll be good to, you know, own a piece of one film that's so obscure. It's actually perfect film to. It's actually a perfect film to have in your physical media collection. Because you know that you've got something that has been so rare and so hard to get, is definitely the way to go. It's like Crosstalk, as you said, hasn't been released for 37 years, and knowing that piece of information in the collector's mentality, think, I must get this, because when is it ever going to be released again after 37 years? So you just grab it, have it in the collection, and it's actually, even though it's terrible, it is actually good to have in the collection, because you know, it's its first physical release, except that in 37 years. So, yeah, it is important. Physical media is definitely important, for sure.
Absolutely, absolutely. I guess we'll give our final thoughts and rating out of 5. For me, this one gets 2 technologically advanced 80s computers out of 5. It's there. It's a film. I feel like there was so much potential, but I guess with what happened behind the scenes and stuff, just led it to be this more dull kind of film. Tony?
A forgettable 2 stars for me as well. It was a very forgettable film. It had some moments, as you said, but all in all, it's forgettable. But it is a 2-star film for me.
And Pete?
I give this about 1.5 out of 5. I just found it an absolute slog from beginning to end. I mean, it definitely had a lot of potential with its premise being like a Rear Window version with an advanced supercomputer in it. But I feel like outside of the supercomputer aspect, if you took that out, it basically would have just been a shot-for-shot remake of Rear Window, but just more boring. Some of the acting is okay. I think the 2 lead actresses were both fine with what they were given. And also the cinematography from Vincent Monten, who, again, is another name we mention a lot on this show, does actually look really good in this film. But outside of that, yeah, it's very, very forgettable and very, very boring.
Well, yeah, that wraps up a bit of a mixed bag with these films. And of course, make your own decision if you want to watch them or not. So, yeah, that's a wrap for this episode. Thank you so much for tuning in, everybody. And we look forward to seeing you again on the next episode. Before we go, you can find us at supermarcy.com. And if you look up the Ozploit cast on your Apple Podcast, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts, you will find us and you can subscribe and give us a like and all that stuff. And always feel free to give us feedback. Have you seen these movies before? What did you think of them? All that stuff is always appreciated as well. And if you want to find me on the interwebs, I am Super Marcy on all the socials, which include Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, Threads. I can't even remember how many there are. And I'm also Super_Marcy on Letterboxd. And you can check out on my profile, I have a list set up with my rankings for all the Ozploitation films from the 70s. So check that out. And of course, once we get through the 80s, I will do that list, or I might just keep a list and add the movies to where they belong as we go. And to our guest, Tony, where can people find you?
You can listen to Imprint Cast and Indicator Cast, which is, of course, hosted by my partner, John Matthews. He's on a well-deserved break at the moment, so that's why we haven't been doing much shows lately, but we do have a big year ahead, definitely, with a couple of huge shows. So you can listen to Imprint Cast and Indicator Cast on Spotify, iTunes, and wherever else you listen to it. But on Imprint Cast, you can listen to it on Amazon Music as well as Google Podcasts. And you can follow us on the Indicator Film Collections Blu-ray fan group, and also the Imprint Cast Blu-ray Information fan group. You can follow us there. You can follow me on Letterboxd under FilmNut79, as well as X, Instagram, and find me on Facebook on the Imprint Films Blu-ray Collections fan group, and I go on and interact with the fellow members as much as I can to keep everything Imprint related and film physical and, of course, physical media related.
Absolutely, and I encourage people to check out those podcasts and check out those groups as well. It's wonderful communities to be a part of. And Beat, where can people find you if they want to check you out?
Well, people want to find me out there on social media. They can find me on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd under Bead Jermaine. And they can also find all my work over at supermarcy.com, and as well as all the awesome podcasts that we co-host over there together, Marcy. And also, people can also find my solo podcast, Bead vs. the Living Dead, and as well as its spin-off show, Bead and Steve vs. Camp Crystal Lake, on all podcast streamers everywhere via the Bead vs. the Living Dead podcast feed. And of course, you can follow all updates on both those shows on social media, on Twitter and Blue Sky under Bead VSTLD, and as well as Facebook under Bead versus the Living Dead.
Excellent, excellent. And once again, thank you, Tony, for joining us. It's wonderful to have you on any podcast at all and to hang out with you. And hopefully there'll be many more, which there will be. We know that, but we won't reveal anything yet.
We certainly won't. And Keith and Marcy, thank you so much for, as always, for the invite. You know, if you need me to be involved in the show, of course, vice versa with Imprint and Indicator, you're more than welcome. And it's always grateful, greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you. Bead, what films will we be discussing on the next episode?
Well, for the February episode of the podcast, we will be discussing the films Dead Easy, The Killing of Angel Street, Goodbye Paradise, Running on Empty, and Turkey Shoot. However, I have I'm excited for this episode because one of these films, which I'm not going to spoil just yet, was actually shot in my old hometown of Cobar. So you'll have to stay tuned next month to find out what that is.
And we will see you at the end of February with episode 14 of the Ozploit cast. Thank you so much, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Base game.